Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics. Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Fred Schenkelberg.
And this is Kirk Gray.
So, Kirk, you kind of let me know as we were chatting before we started that you and your family are, again, breaking blenders and and other household appliances on a regular basis.
Just give them to us and we'll show you where the weaknesses are.
But one of them you mentioned was the... I mean, for blenders, and we've talked about your blender dilemmas for years. And how much force you put on, and you know, but you got to expect that, you know, they're making a blender and no people are going to put ice in it. You know, and I don't suspect you're doing gravel or, you know, trying to tumble rocks in it or stuff like that.
No. And some of it's just a matter of accident. I think this last one was dropped on the base and that's why it cracked the bottom of it. But the more interesting failure, and I don't know, you know, what, how often this happens, but it was a smoke detector we had. We had a real smoky incident in the kitchen where...
And I asked you too, it's not the blender.
It's not the blender. This time it's new. And after, you know, of course, it went off a couple times and pretty soon the smoke cleared and I set it on the table and then put in the battery and it started going off on its own without any smoke around, even outdoors. So I think that, you know, whatever the conductive path in there might have gotten so coated with smoke particles that are made of a small current. I know they ionize the air that comes into there and look for a charged particle current going across, I think, two electrodes. Anyway, that was an unusual mode of failure. So I recently, they're selling smoke detectors now that you don't have to change the batteries. They put in what they guarantee is a 10-year battery life.
Not in your kitchen.
Yeah,
we'll see about that.
Right, we'll test it and make sure, but you know, we'll set it off quite often. And that's the question I have is, you know, these guys, okay, you got a 10-year battery life, you kind of have a power budget, right? Mm-hmm. And you know that this is what a normal monitoring of this would be as far as would take current over time. You know the power. You should know the degradation of your battery also chemically over time. Mm-hmm. And if it loses its charge or how much capacity of the battery totally has. And of course, you'll want to build in a margin because
batteries are different. Charges are different.
And especially our house, it's going to go off a lot more maybe than other houses. Who knows?
Well, I mean, that's not a hard problem. I mean, there's lots of ways to solve that. And I think, I'm drawing a complete blank on his last name. Rob, I'll think of it later, just did a webinar where he was talking about, you know, they're testing cables or he had an example where he's looking at a little handheld vacuum cleaner thing with a nozzle on it. Mm-hmm. And it goes, you know, and so they're brainstorming, thinking about their product or they're getting some field failures or whatever. And they realize that the nozzles are getting too much force applied to them and they're breaking at their attachment. And it'd be like the smoke alarm. We can assume that some of them will be put in a place where they don't go off at all for 10 years.
So
some won't go off at all. Some will go off every day, but those are kind of the extremes, you know, or multiple times a day. Those are extremes. But what would you think would be the nominal or, you know, if you put 10 people in the room and ask them to do this, and this is what a webinar by Chris Jackson on the Bayesian stuff. People are familiar. They have experience with their smoke detectors in their own homes and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And so how often, you know, do they go off on average in an average home?
And in my home, I'd probably be, once every month, maybe on average.
So once a month. And then what's the variability of that?
Oh, I'd say maybe once or twice. Some months it could be twice.
Right. So it'd be some months none, some months, but on average one a month, plus or minus one per month. And in my house, it's probably one at time a quarter, so maybe one time every 6 months for the one that goes off most often. The other one's not at all. Right. So I'd say one in 12 times a year, you know, once a year kind of thing on average, and plus or minus a month, you know, type. And so Chris talked about a technique of Bayesian analysis where you ask people that are familiar with the product and its usage patterns and stuff, and then you average that. And it comes out that when you step back and actually go measure it, it actually is pretty darn close, because you have some experience with it. You have a few people that have a lot of experience with it and one way or the other. And the other way this works is polling the masses, so to speak. So there was a story I listened to the other day about logical techniques and ways of thinking through problems. And so it was discovered by some philosopher back in England, where the local village was going to have a basically guess the weight of the butchered cow or the ox. And whoever got the closest to the actual dressed out weight would receive it. And there were six, and there was a fundraiser, and they raised a bunch of money. And they had like 600 entries, and they kept all the data. So this guy sat down with all the data, and there were some people that were guessing it'd be 30 pounds, and others would be 4,000 pounds, more than the thing weighs to start with, maybe counting the wrapping paper or something. But there was a large spread for most people. And then there were a handful of people that were actually butchers, and they knew how much this would be. And so when you have a wide cross-section of people estimating stuff, there's a lot of noise, right? It's just nonsense stuff. But there was an equal number of people that were over the weight as under the weight. It was just a big spread out, random spread, a big normal curve, but really, really spread out. And then there was like 10% of the population that had a really good idea what it was, because they knew. And so their votes swayed the average dramatically, because they were right on target. And so if you go ask a bunch of people, how many times will this get dropped? There's some people that actually pay attention to that and actually know. And the rest of us are just flat out guessing. And it's by polling. You don't know which ones are guessing and which ones have real knowledge on this. So you ask a bunch of people and you'll actually get a pretty decent answer. And it was kind of magical to me. And I've heard it now from Chris Jackson in his webinar and in this lecture series I was listening to. So it's a technique to do it. But the other one technique I've often seen, and I'm sure you've run into, is just back of the envelope. You go, well, it's going to be zero at the best case and, you know, 20,000 times a day on the worst case, but it's probably somewhere in between. So we'll pick a number in between.
Have to worry about the zero, but we do have to worry about the 20,000. I mean, we have to worry about,
at your house.
Or it going off and not being addressed. You know, of course, your house will burn down, possibly, whatever.
Oh, if it's just a smoky event and it goes for 6 hours just keeps going.
Right. That would certainly take up much of the power budget from the 10 years, possibly.
Yeah. So you just break it down with a number of assumptions, right? And you say, well, it's going to go off and most people will clear it within minutes, and others it might go overnight because nobody's home or who knows.
Yeah, I think there's going to be a wider, but I know that when they've done this kind of questioning of, like, in a computer company that I'm familiar with about a portable computer or laptop type computer, and then they asked the engineers what they thought, how many drops and what kind of G levels it would be and how often. And maybe they, you know, all had a bias that people should be careful with their laptops and not drop them.
Exactly, because they know it's going to break.
But when it came to putting sensors in and starting to record this and track it, and other companies and some of the enterprises, users, they found that they were woefully underestimating the temperatures that the laptops were exposed to and how many drops, you know. And
from distance,
Very conservative.
Yeah.
And when I've talked to, you know, for me, what was interesting, I did ask Jersey Jack Pinball, Eric Munier, who is their, was their head design engineer, about testing pinball machines. And I said, how did you derive what kind of test you do for a pinball machine? He says, well, we all sit down at a table and, you know, and talk about how many times a home user would, you know, activate this particular thing.
Right.
And of course, after that, I thought, well, he's going after the most conservative use, and that is a home user who's not nearly what's going to be done in an arcade that's very active.
That's right. And if it's being run for 12 hours a day, steady.
Absolutely. Right. It's going to be very different. Like, I have two at home, and I know I play maybe once or twice a week on one several machine or several games. But still, he was being a very conservative, you know, they were really doing the minimal of going through the testing that I could conceive that they would do. Mm-hmm. Again, I don't think any pinball manufacturer does ESS or any kind of environmental stressing at all, which I know in pinball would be a very useful methodology because of the electromechanics and the electronics and solder joints and the fact that pinball machines and cells inherently get shaken. They even have huge shaker motors in them that vibrate the heck out of them when you do certain shots. So it always surprised me that they were very, you know, they were sitting down with the same ideas. We would sit down at a table and all the engineers, and I, you know, I just thought that was kind of surprising that we didn't see that they didn't, you know, say or take it to a limit. But pinball machines are expensive. You don't build that many.
Yeah.
I'm sure they'd say we can't afford to put a, you know, $10,000 machine through, you know, breaking it again or whatever.
Right. It's, but we all face those kinds of dilemmas and constraints and everything else. But it's part of this trick is to how to deal with that, though, is I mean, if you can't go measure it, right?
Right.
Then it is back of the envelope in engineering judgment and stuff like that. But it's then in that facilitation is having somebody like you or I there saying, now, wait a second. Let's, what about, it's like Adam Barrett's use case 7. Well, what about, you know, in Kirk's house? What if it really, you know, what if you do it in, if this is an arcade, what if this, what if that, you try to put different stakes in the ground so people start thinking through it in a different way. What if your vendor, you know, goes obsoletes that component and you have to buy the inferior component? How will that affect your performance? And,
right. You're always thinking, you know, we'll make a lifetime buy, whatever, but you can't. You know, that's a good question. Like let's say a more broadly used and certainly more numerous, and that's the smartphone. Mm-hmm. How do those guys, I mean, what, when they're doing design engineering, you know, of course they've always put the same consumer specs of 35C, but how do they actually consider the, you know, what the distribution of drops, how often, distribution of, you know, exposure to outdoor cold temperatures in the winter or Arizona in the summer, you know?
Well, when I was at Hewlett-Packard for the inkjet printers, which they made a bazillion of those things, they would instrument 100 of these or 1,000 of a model and give them to customers and give them ink so they'd be encouraged to use them. And distributing them all over the country in kind of in proportion to where they were being sold. And so they were in San Diego and Miami and up in Colorado and just all over the place. And the deal was, is that they would collect indoor and outdoor weather conditions, temperature, humidity, and a variety of other parameters. They had an accelerometer on it. They had a technique to count how much ink it was using. It never knew what it was printing, but it knew it was going through a lot of black ink or a lot of green ink or whatever. And it had, every time they did the program, they'd come back to the design teams and going, well, what do you need to know? in order to help you make better decisions. And there was marketing stuff and there was other constraints, but it was amazing the amount of information that came back to this, and assumptions about airflow were just thrown out the window when they made a smaller unit that fit on a bookshelf, because then it was packed in books.
Right.
And the vent would be completely blocked off and like, no, you're not getting that airflow there, guys.
Right.
You can't go there anymore.
Right.
The hard part was that was always after the fact. We'd make a zillion model of these units and then instrument up 1,000 so that info became good for the next product. Right?
Yeah, exactly. We guessed wrong now. We found out we weren't right about that.
Yeah,
we
weren't right about that.
And there was only certain things. I remember getting a computer back or seeing a computer back that basically the intake in the fan was almost totally corroded. And of course, we found out that the guy had it at on the seashore in a window facing the beach.
Yeah, and, sucking in the salt mist. Yeah.
Well, he did do the salt spray test.
That's right. He was doing it better than you would.
Yeah.
In a nicer spot, too, not in the lab. But
that's
part
a reasonable
of it,
environment.
Yeah. Well, part of it is with any product, is part of, for me anyway, is setting a reliability goal includes understanding how people are going to use it and what's the range of variables, one that are likely to be present, and then at what extremes is where most people do it, right, is a minimum. Or they go to standards and say, here's the range, and then they ignore how people actually use it. But the other part of that is well, how do these things work in combination? How do they work when they're outside the limits? Or what's the actual nominal value plus the range? What's the distribution, essentially?
Right.
Because if I can't design a product that will, it'll cost us way too much to protect it from this corrosion of the three people in the world that use our product in an open window 20 feet from the crashing waves or on a boat, that's not protected. Now, do we want to design it to meet
those
conditions?
We could have a marine edition.
Marine edition, if we find that there's enough market there. If you would have gotten 2,000 computers back with this corrosion, they're like, wait a sec, there's a market here. You know, maybe not big enough for where you were working, but maybe we can do it. It's not worth penalizing everybody by putting these coatings and different design on it to withstand it because they don't need it. But maybe there's an add-on or a regional variant that we use or whatever. But it starts with first recognizing what's the range of stresses your product is going to see and how often is going to be used. And it often starts, as we said, is just you guess. But you have to be very careful that you're, like you outline, is that are we being too conservative? Are we not understanding how people use our product? Let's get creative here. Let's go give it to some redheaded stepchildren. So I heard one guy say, he actually had a redheaded stepchild. It was a little destructive dynamo himself.
Oh, okay. All right. It's definitely, in any case, it's limited. And that's true. You know, as I say, you really can't afford to build a smartphone that can withstand,
teenagers. For example,
or a 30-foot drop on concrete.
We could design one. Little airbags and parachutes and stuff.
Yeah, and I know that the military, some of the military equipment is pretty robust, but still for the consumer market and competitive markets. You do have a price point that you can't make a $4,000 laptop that, can work underwater.
That's right. Yeah. But there's variations too. If you're in a mass market or, holiday sales or seasonal sales, like smartphones, for example, they sell them seasonally, is the design's all wrapped up. And then it takes them a couple months to ramp up the production, to get them on the shelves. And then they go to market. They have the advantage now, unlike 10, 20 years ago, where they have last year's history and they can learn from how people are using it. There's field data coming in.
They all have temperature sensors in them. They all have accelerometers in them.
Yeah.
You could actually record. I don't know what manufacturers are doing that. I would imagine, you know, Apple could do it internally with a lot of its own people.
Yeah. Tesla, they instrument and they send, it's just part of the deal. Your car is going to talk to us and it's going to send us all kinds of stuff. And
right. So they have thousands of data points. I'm sure that's tough to digest, but they constantly have a online real-time
telemetry
monitoring of their
they got all kinds of cool stuff. But some products, that's just, you are either you're doing an expensive program or you're doing back of the envelope or you're guessing. I know in one product I worked on was a handheld game controller, and one of the risks that was feeding back to mechanical guys is, well, what if somebody sits on it?
Because that happens quite often. Yeah.
Well, it was like a microphone, so it would lay on the couch, and so we went and measured the butt bone pressure on various couches. We actually instrumented up a little system and had people come, hey, come here and sit on this. How much do you weigh? All right, sit on this. Yeah. You know, step on it. Do this. Do that. And
you have
We measured it a bunch. We measured about 30 different people in all these different ways that they could apply pressure to this thing or force to this thing. And we fed that data back to the mechanical engineer. And he at first was like, what? You put this? And we showed him the data.
That's a normal,
way
that it's going to be maybe abused by the designer saying, hey, you're not supposed to sit on it. Well, sorry. You know, that.
So we ended up compromising it. Controller. Yeah, but we compromised with it. We want to make sure if it breaks, it doesn't create sharps. So if you're stepping on it with a bare foot or sitting on it with a pair of shorts on, it doesn't cut you, right? And he goes, okay, I can do that. But at some point, you know, if you jumped on this thing or threw it against the wall, the plastic's going to break.
Right.
But it could withstand quite a bit. And we kind of brainstormed all these different scenarios, and then we went out and measured it. You know, we went and jigged up some stuff and measured the range of forces it could see. And that became a step up from just a flat guess. Oh, yeah, somebody could step on it. Well, there are 200 pounds of this force under that area. We could do some calculations, like 450 pounds for, you know, 3 seconds or whatever. And we could do a 3-point bend test doing that. But we didn't know what the range was. And, yeah, some people can really sit down hard.
Right. And the couches are different cushion, different cushion materials, almost some people, hardly any cushion.
Yeah.
But the thing that bothers me about those controllers is, and the most irritating thing about all these small handheld devices that have removable batteries is the fact that little battery door constantly falls off.
Duct tape. Let me introduce this wonderful device.
The thing's gone, but the batteries are there with the duct tape over them.
And at the critical moment, the batteries fall out.
And that's a reliability issue.
It is.
Because it causes the batteries to fall out. It fails right in the middle of a game, you know.
At the critical moment, too. There's lots of stuff we can learn about how people use our products. I think the last note on it, though, is that you should always be willing to be surprised, because people do what they do. And we can learn from that, or if we're paying attention, I think is the bottom line of it.
Right. Yeah.
So if you're out there breaking stuff like Kirk and family do, dealing with designing a product, you don't know how customers are actually going to use it, you know, drop us a line. What are the types of questions and stuff that make sense in this? This came from one of the part of a question that we received a couple days ago. So we do tailor some of these shows, or a lot of our shows, to what you are interested in. So please head over to ascendoreliability.com/SOR ascendoreliability.com/go/SOR. And you can find Kirk and I on LinkedIn, and on our about pages, we have plenty of ways you can get in touch with us. We'd love to hear from you. So
we have a long history of 5 years now, Fred.
Yeah.
Of podcasts. Probably more than 100.
Between you and
know.
Me, easily, yeah. Between
yeah,
you and me,
it's
easily.
Crazy. You've got thousands. And
We're close to, this episode is number 580 in our log. So we're at, and then we did a couple of special episodes that aren't in that sequence. So we're pretty darn close, if not already over 600 total episodes.
Okay, well, we'll have to have another special show at 1,000.
Oh, yeah. We got a little ways to go for that, but not too far.
Okay.
All right. Thanks, Kirk. Talk to you soon.
Okay, Fred. Talk to you later.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation. If you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show, please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.